to Prescription Advocacy. I'm Arielle Troster.
And I'm Dr. Neely Kaplan-Murth, and today we're honored to be joined by Dr. Maya Goldenberg, who is an associate professor at the University of Guelph with expertise in the philosophy of medicine. Welcome, Dr. Goldenberg.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So I'm going to jump on this right away because I am really excited to hear that your specialty is addressing vaccine hesitancy, which even though I'm seeing a total Hunger Games among my friends and family to try to get their vaccines, I'm hearing that there is a lot of hesitancy in Canada, and that could be a concern for us as we try to end this pandemic. So I'm very interested in the work you do and what you've been seeing in the last year.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about it. So I've been working on vaccine hesitancy for just over 5 years. I had actually just finished a book manuscript on vaccine hesitancy as the pandemic was just starting it. So I was just finishing up the last of the final draft. And that work was on pediatric vaccine hesitancy. So back when we used to talk about vaccine hesitancy before COVID, we were talking about parents who didn't want to vaccinate their kids. And I couldn't talk about the whole global perspective because that you don't want to try to address it too broadly. But I could say some things about the specific situation around parents who hesitate around vaccines in industrialized nations. And that cohort actually gets a lot of attention, a lot of scorn by science bloggers and the media, because it seems odd to people who are much more confident about vaccines that despite the widespread availability of vaccines, strong scientific consensus, we've got these parents who don't want to vaccinate their kids. And I entered this as a philosopher. This area of research, I should say, is usually the domain of behavioral science. But as a philosopher of science and medicine, I thought there was work that I could do specific to my skill set and domain. And I entered the field sort of with the knowledge. This is sort of general truths that were accepted about vaccine hesitancy among parents in industrialized nations. It is that parents who hesitate about vaccines have some kind of problem with science. They either don't understand it, don't respect it. Something about science illiteracy is at work here. And the second factor is that it is a problem of rich white people. So it's seen as an affluence problem. And there is actually social science research that backs that up, showing that at least among parents that are polled, or use measurement data is generated around parents where they measure vaccine hesitancy, they find more vaccine hesitancy among higher income households than lower income households. So I entered there. I assumed those things were true, that it was a science illiteracy problem and an affluence issue. And I wanted to figure out first, the first question, what is with these people? What evidence was going to convince them that vaccines are safe and effective and necessary? And as I got into that research, I realized very quickly that I was asking the wrong question. And in fact, that widely held view that it's a science illiteracy problem is wrong. It's not, there is not a science illiteracy problem. It isn't to say that everyone understands vaccine research and science perfectly. In fact, most of us don't, but that's not what's driving vaccine hesitancy. The second finding, this idea that it was only rich white people that were worried and frustrated about vaccines, was also false. It was only demonstrated in social science research that had failed to use inclusive methods to bring in a wider diversity of respondents. So they were doing research on white people and they were getting that finding. So right away, there was a lot of work to be done. And most importantly, to come up with an alternative theoretical framework for understanding vaccine hesitancy. And as a philosopher, that's something I can do. I can analyze arguments first to show which ones are wrong, but then I can also offer new theories. And I did. I proposed that vaccine hesitancy stems from a problem of mistrust, specifically mistrust in the institutional structures that bring us vaccines, that the development, manufacturing, regulation, and of course, distribution of vaccines. So that was what I argued regarding pediatric vaccine. Fast forward to COVID, which was, as I mentioned, declared a pandemic after I'd finished this research. And actually those issues around the sort of social context that shapes vaccine hesitancy is more obvious now than it was regarding pediatric vaccines because of the newness of the vaccines, because of the way that COVID has impacted different communities differentially. We are now seeing that vaccine distribution and vaccine confidence around COVID vaccines is following those measures where it is racialized communities and communities that are hardest hit that are more hesitant about vaccines. And also, it is not clearly a science literacy problem that is making people fearful of COVID vaccines, even though there is a lot of misinformation out there.
That's amazing.
Wow. So my question to you is, if it isn't true that this is concentrated among rich white people, you know, we know the stereotype. They do the yoga, they eat the granola, they send their kids to alternative schools, they don't vaccinate. Yeah. Although there's certainly, we're seeing pockets of that all over the place. What is the primary driver? So you say it's a lack of trust in medicine or in the people who are promoting vaccines. What are the main reasons why people are refusing or people are hesitant if it's not a lack of knowledge about science?
The major sources of mistrust, so I can tell you, I generated this idea by reading a lot of social science research on parents. For all the media sources that would write about these, you know, awful, selfish, illiterate parents, they were ignoring a huge body of social science research that actually asks parents, why are you vaccine hesitant? It's a very widely researched topic. And there were themes that would come up in the transcripts again and again, not just in Canada, but in other industrialized nations too. The biggest one was fearful about a pharmaceutical industry influence on health research. That was said again and again. And I'll say that parents could not be clearer about how mistrusting they are of the current arrangements around regulation of medical technologies. And that is an issue that I should say even the rich white people are concerned about, because that's something they cannot protect themselves against by using their privilege and whatever. There was also the issue of the term for it in philosophy is epistemic injustice. It's the feeling that largely that the frequent story of mothers going to their physicians to talk about vaccines and getting shut down and made to feel stupid for even asking questions. And that is a terrible situation that seems to get repeated again and again. You read it in the narratives that vaccine hesitant and refusing parents tell. I went to my doctor to ask questions for my baby. And it what it does is it makes people feel embarrassed and frustrated. It makes them mistrustful of their own physician. It makes them go look for information elsewhere, where they find communities that are more supportive of their questions and their inquiries online. And by doing that, I'm sure physicians don't mean to do this, but by shutting down a mother, it's usually a mother's questions, you are reproducing this problem in healthcare where women's concerns get trivialized. And many of these new mothers might have already had that experience in their prenatal care and in their birthing experience. And it doesn't sit right when they get shut down for doing what they actually think a good mother is supposed to do, which is ask questions and be very careful in the decisions they make around their kids. The last reason that there is vaccine hesitancy, and this is not confirmed by research in pediatric care, just because the research hasn't been done, is racialized communities generally have mistrust of the healthcare system due to historic and contemporary injustices and abuses. And that, of course, is going to gravitate towards their trust in a new vaccine and other healthcare products.
So, like, as a family doctor, I've sat, and I guess like you, because you, as you said, you started all of this long before the pandemic, like I have been in practice for 11 years or however long it's been. And it's what we do all the time. We're counseling parents in terms of immunizing their infants. And I think in my practice of about 1,400 patients, I had maybe two or three dozen who were refusing to immunize their kids. And over time, some of them, by sitting with them and talking with them and answering their questions, I was able to sufficiently answer their questions, and we built that relationship. And so then eventually they would agree to immunize on whatever delayed schedule. And I would say, okay, fine, you don't want to do three shots in one day, not a problem. We'll do it this way. And but I find that with the pandemic, that new kind of loss of trust in the system is harder to deal with, because even as physicians, we are constantly having to change our tune, right? So even if we say, no, but the science is evolving and, you know, what we're saying today makes sense based on what we know today, it's really hard even for some of the people who were not anti-vax before to accept what we're telling them. So yesterday I spent more than an hour with a patient, and she had all kinds of really good questions. She wanted to know how mRNA vaccines work. She wanted to know whether they were going to affect her fertility. She wanted to know whether it would interfere with the metabolism of her other medication. She wanted to know how the immune system works and how that's different from the autoimmune diseases that she hears about. And so many questions. Those kinds of questions I can answer. But then when people are losing their faith in our system because of politics and because we keep changing our answers, that's a lot harder, I find.
You're expressing a common communications difficulty, and I think that's been a problem throughout the pandemic, that the science is evolving, and because of that, the messaging is changing. I mean, look at our public health officers at the provincial and federal level. They are struggling with that too. There isn't an easy answer with how you convince everyone. All you can do is keep saying it and keep justifying and explaining it. So you say things like, yes, we used to think this was a good way to treat the problem, but things have changed. And this is actually a sign that our knowledge is advancing. There's repeating that, and hopefully it gets through to people that it's actually a strength of science, that science can self-correct rather than just stick to one fact and hold on to it dogmatically. If we did that, that would be a mistake. I take it that another challenge that physicians are having, and as well as patients, is we don't have the same kind of contact with our physicians anymore. We've sort of scaled healthcare back to the more essential stuff, and we're using Zoom instead of seeing each other face to face unless necessary. So the kind of sensitive conversations you would have had with a mother, usually a mother, around with her children, and the face-to-face, of course, is meaningful for like creating those connections, is not happening right now.
It is actually happening. I'll just jump in there and say, like, we've actually been seeing, absolutely, and most family doctors have been seeing parents and babies throughout the pandemic. That has been our priority since day one. And I mean, in our practice, we've been seeing everybody in office who wants to come into office for the better part of a year. It just dawned on me, how much is social media and how much is the ways in which misinformation can travel so much more quickly now? How much does that influence the hesitancy? Do you know if there was historically, like when polio vaccine became available, was there hesitancy? Because my patients who were children at the time tell me that they went up and down the block and they just immunized everybody. And for people who watched their neighbors get polio, and like, it was just like, it was a kind of no brainer. You just did it. But I wonder whether that's because of the way that information travels now.
Right. The information landscape is more complicated now. Now, I know from research into misinformation and conspiracy theories that they have long existed, long before the internet. But the internet, of course, amplifies it and gets more information out to people much quicker. And it makes it more difficult to process it. So there's, first of all, more information, more misinformation, and less time to start working through it. So it leaves a lot of people on the fence. You actually don't meet that many people that are fully committed to wild theories about 5G networks and vaccines. What you do meet are the people that are saying, I don't know about these vaccines because there's stuff I've been hearing. So it's kind of like the passive recipient of information rather than people who are fully in there. And unfortunately, we don't have the time and mental space to work through that. So it complicates things, but it's not like it didn't exist before the internet. And even if we fully regulated the internet, which seems impossible at this point, but even if we could do that, there would probably still be misinformation out there.
Yeah, I'm mildly obsessed with cults, and I'm completely fascinated in the mechanism. No, I really am, because I find it really interesting to think about that fine line between community and indoctrination, between information mm-hmm. and misinformation. And so, yeah, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, and there was a great episode of one of my favorite podcasts called Maintenance Phase, where they talked about basically the wellness to QAnon pipeline, which is a lot of anti-vaccine stuff is implicated in that, and about how it was a deliberate strategy that a lot of the misinformation, especially in the United States around this, you know, other entirely wild theory, was spread through Instagram. It was spread through sort of very feminine coded memes. That whole, oh, I'm just asking questions. Like, what about the children? This whole save the children thing. The question I have for you is, so I have a neighbor who's trying to convince a good friend of hers to become vaccinated. And she's very much in that liminal state that you described, you know, just asking questions, wanting to do her own research, not sure what to trust. And that, of course, is difficult for me to understand. But for someone who is intelligent and who thinks that they're just doing their own research, how would you talk to that person, or would you suggest talking to that person about how to find sources that are credible, or how to find information that she might be able to trust? Because I don't believe she has a family doctor that she trusts the way that Neely's patient might trust her. And I think that's the case for a lot of people in Canada.
Right. Yeah. It's a difficult question, just because there isn't sort of one strategy for doing it. All the communications research, and there was actually quite a lot of communications research on how do you talk to vaccine hesitant parents, and it's usually actually directed at how do healthcare providers talk to vaccine hesitant parents. It always talks about the general findings are do it kindly. Don't do anything that will make someone feel defensive or get their back up against the wall. Sometimes throwing facts at them can do that. Not that they aren't looking for information, but it needs to be done in a more collaborative way than here's what you need to know, here's 15 links. And there you go. It's also important to pay attention to what their actual concerns are. So, you know, so tell me, what is it that about, let's say, the general guidelines being given by our public health officers that you are concerned about, and to try to respond to that. When you listen to what they have to say, you're more likely to be able to identify what's going on there. There can be information gaps. There can be disinformation that they're repeating. There can also be just general anxiety over the uncertainty of it all, because we don't know exactly how we are each going to respond to each vaccine, especially this new vaccine. We don't have long-term data. It's actually, I'd say it's a harder decision than it was for pediatric vaccines, some of them we've been using for decades. So you kind of need to get really specific about what the points are and try to do it in a kind way. And more than anything, don't make a person feel stupid because they are not as confident about vaccines as you are. And I say that not to judge you at all, but because we do that all the time. Yeah. And we're all kind of stressed right now. And in the conversations we have, whether online or even, you know, talking to people we know, there's this tendency to get frustrated and to sort of other that person as they must be stupid, they must be crazy, they must be something like that, instead of trying a more charitable view, is they might be a lot like me, but there's something missing that doesn't make them confident about vaccines like I am. So you know, you could try that. You say, here's why I feel good about vaccinating my children or myself. Why do you feel differently about that, and see where you guys differ on that?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't work in the medical field, but I'm a communications advisor in my day job. So as a professional communicator, I got to say this pandemic has been very frustrating. And this latest debacle, I mean, I very happily took the AstraZeneca vaccine, but the communications debacle around a vaccine where they told people, take the first vaccine available, they're all safe. And then they said, maybe they aren't safe. And now they're saying, take your second dose, it's probably safe. I mean, it's a losing battle here. And so I remain confident in my choice, but a lot of people are feeling very, especially, you know, there was a hashtag Gen X Zeneca, like all the Gen Xers who decided to go out and take this vaccine are feeling very cheated. Like maybe they got the bad vaccine, like they took on a risk that no one else took, and they truly don't know what to do. And I mean, that's not normal hesitancy. That's a reaction to a serious communications failure, as far as I'm concerned. So it's tough. I'm not making our jobs easy.
I agree. We the public were I'm one of those Gen Xers, and I rushed out to get that AstraZeneca vaccine, and I still feel good about the choice. In fact, if someone gave me this choice for a second one, I'm ready for that too. However, I feel like I was not spoken to in a very open way. It's maybe, okay, some of the calculations came out afterwards saying that the blood clots were more frequent than they thought, but really that conversation of the message of take anyone because they're all good, that probably was not the case even when they were saying it. And that's a communications failure for a number of reasons. You probably know this already, but overstating confidence in order to get the public to come along is not helpful if later they find out you were overstating. And that can actually be more damaging to public trust when you give this sort of false certainty that maybe wasn't there after all.
Yeah, and now it seems to be fueling hesitancy about Moderna versus Pfizer, which is essentially the same vaccine. And so, you know, people asking which brand they're getting. And I keep saying, like, I literally do not know the brand name of any other vaccine I've received in my entire mm-hmm. life, except maybe Gardasil. But other than that, no idea. But this sort of, you know, and people hashtagging which brand of vaccine that they got, like, it's creating this kind of individualist consumer approach to getting the vaccine instead of this collective approach. But it wasn't helped by the way this rollout was handled at all.
Well, I have nightmares that, you know, the 825 people that I gave AstraZeneca to, that if any of them got sick, you know, that feels like, you know, but I told them this is okay. And I have to trust that whatever the National Advisory Committee tells me is correct, and that Health Canada is correct. And I have to just have faith, because I mean, that's what we do all the time in everything in medicine, right? Like, and I will be humble, and I will tell my patients, yes, well, we did used to say that everybody should be on baby aspirin, but now actually, you know, we don't think everybody needs to be on a baby aspirin just because blah, blah, blah. So the, you know, as things change, in fact, in medical school, one of the things that we were taught in medical school is that 5 years after we graduated, half of what we had learned would be outdated. And that was said to us as just fact, like that is going to be what happens. And so you have to be continually, you know, keeping up with new medical education. And so if you work within that system and you know that information and knowledge changes, then it's not quite as startling when you hear one day that, you know, this is the risk, and then another day that, okay, actually we've recalculated the risk. I get that, and I understand why it frightens people. I just wish that, the communication part where the media keeps picking up on every possible nightmarish scenario, and then, you know, and then I'm totally shocked that people are debating the relative value of Moderna and Pfizer. Like, what on what planet are people saying that one is better than the other? And I mean, I can't keep up with what the reasons are that people are saying that, but you know, yet again, we're getting 400 doses of Moderna and that's what we're giving. And I don't understand when people say, oh, no, I'd rather wait for Pfizer. So I think one other thing that isn't hesitancy, but it's an entitlement thing that is really bothering me is the shopping and the sense that somebody is more important than another person. And that idea of hunting, I know vax hunters are like volunteers and good for them, but we should not be hunting for vaccines. And that whole attitude where people, like I had somebody yesterday who tried to go and sneak into a pharmacy and get a dose of Pfizer where we had given them AstraZeneca not even a month ago, and patently lied to the pharmacist and said, no, I haven't had it. And then the pharmacist writes to me and says, you know, Dr. Kaplan-Murth, this person is claiming that they haven't had it, but we can see on COVAX Ontario that they did. And I'm like, yeah, that's weird. They did. And then when I speak to the patient, they're like, oh no, you know, I was on multiple wait lists and the pharmacists are sending out messages now to say something's available. So I just figured, oh, well then I must be eligible. But I don't believe it because the shopping. Anyway, that to me, that is something that is exhausting and demoralizing, that people would elbow and push in front of others rather than, you know, respectfully following what we're saying is, you know, the correct wait time for another vaccine and which vaccine you're going to get and so on. But there's also unequal distribution across Ontario, which is another thing, which is Toronto is plentiful vaccine. Ottawa, we have very little. And so people in Toronto saying, I don't know what the problem is. I can just go to any pharmacy within, you know, stone's throw of my house and I can get the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And then other people have to travel hundreds of kilometers. So anyway.
Yeah. I mean, your comments, I mean, we could scale that out to the global distribution of vaccines too. I mean, right now, 75% of the world's vaccines have been distributed in 10 countries. I think the WHO just came out with that a few days ago. That is appalling, especially just to, you know, make the practical point that a global pandemic will not go away if we just vaccinate 10 countries. And even if everyone gets a second shot, yet there's this sort of idea about scarce resources, even at a time when there actually, at least in some respects, there are lots of resources, and this unwillingness to share it because there might not be enough for yourself. So yes, I'm aware of people showing up and trying to shop around, and it actually just got worse. There's an article in the Toronto Star from today called Vaccine Vultures in Versace. You should read it unless it's going to make you really mad, but it's people showing up at pop-up clinics in essential worker neighborhoods. And it's pretty obvious that they're not part of that group because they're in luxury cars and fancy clothes, and they're screaming and harassing staff because they want their second shot before the people in the neighborhood even get their first. I mean, that's despicable.
So if you could send a message to somebody who might be listening to this podcast, who is on the fence about getting vaccinated, what would you say to them? I mean, I know that you are a passionate advocate for vaccines, but if there's any message you could send through this appearance on our podcast, what would you say to people who are feeling like they're not being heard or like the information out there is just too much? Do you have sources that you point to? Do you have something specific you would say?
My suggestion is to go talk to someone who you trust, and we trust people for two reasons. So when we look to other people, to experts, to other people for information all the time, because there is too much out there to know for ourselves. So sometimes we look to our doctors, sometimes we look to our mothers or our friends. So think about who is a reliable source on vaccines. So they will presumably have some up-to-date information about vaccines, but they also should have a good character. They're the people that have your interests at heart. Find that person and talk through vaccines with you. The people on the internet do not know you. They don't have your interests at heart. If you don't trust your doctor, find someone else to talk to that hopefully has the same kind of expertise, at least the medical training or scientific training, and try to talk through the problem. Right now, yes, I will tell anyone that the evidence in favor of the COVID vaccines is really compelling. I don't say that because I have insider information, but because I'm a news reader like everyone else, it is very compelling. But if it's not convincing for you, find out what you need to know and then decide if it's the worst thing you can do is try to fill in the gaps in your sort of information and your thinking with something you read on the internet.
And I think it's important that we recognize and validate the colonial history and the ways in which medicine has historically been abusive to populations. And by recognizing that and talking about that, that's also a way that we can build new trust, hopefully. And I've seen great, like the Indigenous immunization strategies in Ottawa and I think elsewhere have done an amazing job going out into community and people who are First Nations, Inuit, and Métis being able to go to in Ottawa, it's Wabanaw, and there's it being able to do that has been really important, but we haven't necessarily done that in all the different marginalized groups across Canada.
Right. There's been some good efforts. You might know the South Asian COVID-19 Task Force, the Black Scientist COVID Task Force in, I think they're based in Toronto, but they do all of Ontario. They're doing the good work. And what they're doing is they're doing something that's well known in the vaccine communications and other sort of public communications research around contentious issues is it matters who says it, not just what they say. So if you've got a community that has might have very good reason not to trust, the healthcare system or politicians or experts in general, they are more likely to listen and have good reason to be more open to discussions with someone from their community. So we're pooling local talent. We're getting South Asian doctors and physicians and scientists to do town hall meetings, usually on Zoom, to talk to their community, to discuss, often giving the same scientific information that you would get off of a public health website, but it's culturally sensitive. It's trauma-informed if need be. It can be done in the languages of the community, and people are more likely to listen if it's coming from someone who they think shares their history and understands their values.
Yeah. And also, I think we need to understand too that the assumption often is that there's hesitancy when there actually is lack of access. So I was reading about some volunteers who were doing phone calls in Chinatown in Toronto, and the concern wasn't about the vaccine. People were worried that getting the vaccine would put them on immigration's radar if they were undocumented, and they needed mm-hmm. reassurance that they would not be, that their information would not be sent to immigration. And so having those people speaking to their community members in their own language to address those concerns goes a really, really long way. And yeah, I saw inspiring examples, Chinatown in Toronto. There was a great clinic for primarily Black people in Toronto where they had a DJ and they had Jamaican patties and soup in the waiting area, and just really creating a joyful community experience for vaccination. And the Chinatown clinic had dragon dancers and, you know, all sorts of cultural experiences. So yeah, it's really exciting to see.
That sounds great. And are they not asking for ID? Is that how they're working around the immigration concerns?
There's definitely
as soon as I understand the people who say you say you're not going to check my record, but what if it happens after the fact? I can appreciate that concern. Yeah. That's been expressed by undocumented people in the United States. I know that.
Yeah. Now I'd have to verify, but my understanding is there are certain clinics that are specifically barrier-free where they don't ask at all, and their tracking system is, they keep it private to some degree. And then sometimes it might just be the reassurance of hearing from someone from your own community, but that tends to only be happening in the larger cities like Toronto. Just as Neely said, other cities that may have people with the same concerns don't necessarily have the ability to set up all those targeted clinics and to ensure that level of safety. I know there was also in Toronto, they had vaccine clinics, specific accommodations for people with anxiety, people with disabilities, people who wanted privacy. I hear of one targeted to the Orthodox Jewish and Muslim communities where you can request the gender of the doctor who gives the vaccine. You can choose to be covered or uncovered. So
I had a patient who came in during Jabbapalooza who she needed to have privacy. And so I knew that. So when she came in, she came into my examining room as opposed to our kind of vaccination station that we had set up out in the waiting room. And she came in and I locked the doors front and back so nobody could come in and interrupt us. And then she was comfortable, undressing enough to be immunized. And it's so important. The flip side of all of this is that one of the patients that I spoke to yesterday at length, she asked me, Dr. Kaplan-Murth, if I don't get the vaccine, are they going to still let me go to work? And so our conversations about that, and when you see about vaccine passports and so on like that, you know, so I said to her, well, look, when we have patients who refuse to immunize their kids, they're still allowed to go to school, but they have to declare that they've chosen not to. And, you know, so sort of ended up talking to her about human rights and you know, that, but that it would also probably be very difficult for her if she wants to travel back home where her family is outside of Canada. And that, you know, so that's going to also foster people's lack of trust. Or the only other thing I was going to go back and just add that, health cards, provincial health cards are not required for vaccination. Being a Canadian is not even required for being vaccinated. If you show up at a clinic and it's a sort of walk-in style clinic, there, our College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario have said that that we are allowed to immunize anybody irrespective of whether or not they are Ontario residents. And so that means that when we input data into COVAX Ontario, when we upload the information about the vaccine that they've gotten, it's not actually required that they have an OHIP number. So all that's required is a name and an email address, really, for them to get verification that they've had that vaccine. So that would be one way that people could potentially protect their own privacy if they were worried about being tracked. Anyway, we should probably draw this to a close, but thank you, Dr. Goldenberg, for speaking with us today. And this is a conversation that we're going to, I'm sure, keep coming back to as our vaccine rollout continues to be somewhat chaotic. Is there anything that either of you wanted to add before we say goodbye?
Well, I just wanted to thank you so much for your perspective. I think it'll be really helpful for people because, this vaccine rollout, even though there's been so many snafus from the top, it's really being driven by people helping each other. And so I think people sincerely want to help each other. And so if this can help someone start a conversation with someone who's hesitating about being vaccinated, I think that's really great. So we really appreciate your compassionate and data-informed approach.
Thank you. It's nice to end it on a good note. I mean, you see a lot of the good work that's being done too after, over a year of so much hardship. You see the outreach and the efforts and the thinking about how to reach people that are hard to reach. And that's the good part. That's the good coming through.
You've been listening to Prescription Advocacy, co-hosted by Dr. Neely Kaplan-Murth and Ariel Troster, produced by Alana Stewart. You can visit us on Twitter at RxAdvocacy or on our website at rxadvocacy.ca, where you'll find links to the people that we spoke with and the information that they provided, and also a full list of credits. Thank you for listening.